Well, I'm going to go ahead and open up in a word of prayer. Looks like everyone's here is going to be here. Father, once again, we're so thankful for this privilege to come together. Thank you for the beautiful day. And we just pray that you bless this time. Let it be a time that's time where we're opening up our hearts to the truths and the principles that will be seen in the book of Ezekiel. And we pray all these things are done in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
All righty. So we're in chapter 4. We actually finished the first three chapters. And what are the first three chapters? That's kind of the introduction where God is initiating and getting Ezekiel ready for the ministry. Now that we're in chapter 4, it's going to begin by actually doing some of the things he's going to be doing, some of his ministry, which is unique kind of a ministry. The kind of things he's going to do are going to be different from any other prophet. And most of the prophets are speaking prophets, and they speak words, and he'll have some messages along the way, but most of what he's going to be doing is at least initially, he's going to be, he'll do some signs and visuals. So chapters 4 through 7, if you have the handout that was the outline of the entire book, you see it was about the disobedient nation. And so we're looking at chapter 4 today, and that's the beginning of it. And he was a young guy. He started his ministry at about 25. So, you know, a lot of times people have images of different prophets. They say Ezekiel, and they show him as a really old man. Well, no, he wasn't. He wasn't an old guy at all. We like that old look with gray hair and all that, a distinguished look, wisdom and all that, but that's not exactly who he was. He was a much younger guy when he started ministry. So at least 25, he was 25 when he was taken captive, and then 5 years later, so I should say at 30 is when he actually began his actual ministry. So chapters 4 through 7, let me just break that down. Sometimes it's good to see, you know, where we're headed, what we're going to be seeing as we dive into it. So chapters 4 and 5 are going to be about signs of coming judgment. And the signs are going to be the dramatized things that he's going to do. He's going to dramatize or put on like a little skit every day at his house. And the elders come to see him at his house, probably outside of his home, where he puts on this little skit. He's not speaking, he's doing. And this is part of it. They're supposed to watch this going on. So the four signs of coming judgment, chapters 4 and 5. The first one's going to be the sign of the brick. And I'll show you some images of a lot of these things. The brick that they would use, what they would call a brick. But they were like soft clay, and they could engrave on it. A lot of times they would put words on it, and then they would bake it, and it'd be hard with the words built into the clay. And that was what they mean by a brick. So we're talking about that. So that's the first of it. Then the second sign is going to be, also in chapter 4, is Ezekiel laying on his sides. He'll lay on one side for 390 days, on another side for 40 days, right? And all those are significant, and they're a sign. And all the whole point is to communicate to the Israelites, especially those in captivity, they're actually in Babylon, that he's ministering to those in Babylon. So the sign of the brick, the sign of lying on his sides, and those are kind of famous ones. And the third one people don't like to talk about is the sign of the unclean food. The unclean food, and we're talking about that. It's not the means that they're used to cook that food is kind of gross, but God's doing it for a reason. All that has to do with the siege that's going to happen to Jerusalem. Then when we get to chapter 5, he's going to talk about the shaved head. He shaves his hair, and then he's going to cut it up into several different segments of his hair, and each segment represents something. It's kind of amazing. So this is very dramatized. He's literally going to cut his hair off, and he's going to cut it up, and God's going to tell him where to put those pieces, portions of it. Now, that's the signs in chapter 4 and 5. When you get to 6 and 7, it's all talk about the disobedient nation, but when you get to 6 and 7, he'll finally have a message that he'll speak. Right, and during this first chapters 4 and 5, he's not speaking at all. He's just dramatizing. He's just doing this, and they're all like, "What's wrong? Tell us what this means." And they need to figure it out by what he's doing. And I think they probably do understand the implication of it. So chapter 6 and 7 is going to be two messages of coming judgment. Again, message of idolatry as the cause of this judgment. And, you know, is adultery just simply the idea of having an idol and you worship it? And a lot of people like to narrow it down to that. No, it's something we can be doing today when you have anything that you put before the Lord, that's idolatry. Right? So it's not like an old thing that happens in the Old Testament, doesn't happen to us. It obviously can be something going on in our own life today. And then chapter 7 is going to be the message of the nature of judgment. He'll talk more about the nature of judgment. So there is some communication that will go on in chapter 6 and 7. So you got the signs, followed by the message, and then we progress on through the book. And so let me talk about a couple points as we dive into this first, these chapters, because I think we need a little bit of background to understand what's going on. So Ezekiel is in Babylon, right, and the captives in Babylon are seeing this message of Jerusalem's coming destruction. So he's in Babylon, he's going to be doing this dramatization every day, and over and over and over again. They're going to see it for a long time. In fact, it's leading up to this last judgment going to come on Jerusalem in 586 BC, just a few years away. And it's going to be a siege that comes in and destroys Jerusalem. But he's talking to the people that have already been taken out of Jerusalem, because remember, Jerusalem's been overrun a couple of times by Babylon already. And so, and each time, more and more people were taken captive. This time, they're actually going to destroy the city completely, and the temple will be destroyed. And that's a huge part of Ezekiel. More emphasis on the temple in Ezekiel than really any of the other prophets. I mean, by far, it's pretty obvious there's a focus there. Partly because he's a priest. He's of the priestly line, Levi. And so, as a priestly line, everything about his life is about the activities around the temple. So the Lord uses him specifically in the context of what he's the most familiar with. So he's talking, he's in Babylon, ministering to those captives in Babylon, but he's giving a message about what's going to happen in Jerusalem. And in the end, this looks like a thing, you know, they're in captivity, Jerusalem's going to be destroyed, and the temple is going to be destroyed. And it's kind of like, well, what's the purpose of living? I mean, to them, it's kind of like hopeless. I mean, they're hoping to maybe get away and maybe go back home and go back to a normal life. Well, normal life isn't going to happen for them. There's no normal life. Oh, and by the way, the thing you're hoping for, the temple, is going to be destroyed too. Well, that's impossible to imagine in their world, but this is what God's going to do. So this message likely causes them to lose hope, and they say they may have a false optimism that there may be some chance that we'll be able to go back. Now, if they've heard Jeremiah, they would know that their time of captivity is going to be for 70 years. I mean, specifically, Jeremiah talks about how long it's going to be, but how many are believing all the prophets? How many are believing that, you know, that's going to end at, what, 536 BC. So they got a number of years, but they're going to be 70 years total in captivity. The Judahites will be specifically. So here's the first series of prophecies, and this is a prophecy. Now, these prophecies aren't, again, words. These prophecies are actions, right? Well, so when we say prophecy, we usually think of, well, we read the prophecy and we try to understand what it means and all that. That's true, but this is actually still a prophecy, because it's things that's going to happen in Jerusalem. It hasn't happened quite yet, but it's going to, but he's dramatizing it, so it's still a prophecy. Here's the first series of prophecies given over a year's time, right? So there's a period of time before it happens, just like the siege itself doesn't happen overnight. It's quite a process of sieging and destroying the city. Just like that takes a long time, he's going to be doing this over a long period of time. So here's the first series of prophecies given over a year's time of Jerusalem's conquest by the Babylonians in 586. So their captors still have their army out there. The captors, being the Babylonians, are going to take them. They're still going to go back to Jerusalem one more time. It'll be the third time. And this time, they completely burn the city, wipe it out. The temple and everything is taken out of existence. That would be Solomon's temple, right? Ezekiel acted out the coming siege and the fall of Jerusalem before it actually happened. Again, this prophecy, he's not saying words, he's doing words. He's doing a dramatization that tells them what's going to happen. And they're going to see this over and over again as it leads up to the actual event. It's pretty amazing how God's doing this. So God gave Ezekiel specific instructions about what to do and to say. He wasn't saying much. As you listen to the text, you see it's him doing. And how to do it and how to say it. Each detail had a specific meaning. So the point is, God gave him instruction of what this means, and so he could dramatize it the best he could to express what's going to happen over in Jerusalem, which is pretty hard for them to hear. So this occurred exactly 4 years before the siege of Jerusalem of Babylon. So you understand, he's going to do this for quite a time. Quite a long time. Every day, the same thing, every day, he's going to bring, and I'll show you visually what it looks like. So this occurred exactly 4 years before the siege of Jerusalem and Babylon, which was 586, which resulted in the total destruction. So 4 years beforehand, they're giving this prophecy by enactment, this skit, if you will, that he's rolling out, playing out, that actually will represent what will actually take place in Jerusalem. So understanding that, that means that the last part of that four-year period that he's dealing with here is when it was actually going on. So he's told it before the siege began and during the time of the siege until the actual time of the siege, and then he ended. Pretty amazing timing what God's doing there. So Ezekiel 4:5 is one sustained dramatic act of foreshadowing the siege of Jerusalem. He's giving this information, this event that he's supposed to keep doing over and over, and it represents the siege. So Ezekiel 4:5 contains a series of silent dramatic acts related to God's enforcement, enforced silence. In chapter 3, he talks about, I'm going to make your tongue cleave to the top of your mouth so you can't speak. So when he's doing this, sometimes he might want to say, you guys understand what this means? No. He's not going to be giving them a running commentary. They're going to see it, and they're going to have to think it through and realize what he's doing. And I think you'll see they're probably going to understand what he's saying is going to happen. They just don't want to believe it. So again, the outline itself, we're still looking at the chapters 4 through 24, right? We're just starting today, which is very personal. All that's about personal, what's your relationship with the Lord type of thing. And the sinfulness of Israel and the fall of Jerusalem is specific, right, in 4 through 24, exactly what we're looking at. Then he'll move on, and he'll talk about the other nations that are surrounding Israel. And then, of course, in 33 through 48 is the prophecy stuff that is still yet future from our time to even today. So that's the stuff that will matter then. And so anyway, we're in chapter 4 through 24, and 4 through 7 specifically is about the disobedient nation itself. So the first dramatization is verses 1 through 8, so we'll go into that, and that's the siege, concerning the siege of Jerusalem. And the siege is where you surround the city and don't allow anything in and out, and eventually run out of water, eventually run out of food, and all that goes with it. So Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 1, you also, son of man, take a clay tablet and lay it before you and portray on it a city, Jerusalem. Portraying it. Remember I mentioned earlier it can be soft, and so there's like this clay, and it gets kind of tacky and soft, and you can draw on it or write words on it, and then they would bake it, and it would become hard, and when it becomes hard, it's, you know, whatever you wrote or carved or whatever in there becomes embedded, and it becomes more stiff. It stays there. So there's all kinds of these images where this is one of them itself, and they actually drew, this is actually very old clay tablet, where they drew out this symbol. But the idea that he's actually holding the clay tablet on a clay tablet, right, is showing they would do this to communicate. That was one early way they could write on scrolls later on in the papyri and all that. But they would actually take these things, the clay, and write on it. We have a number of them they go back to the time of, well, even as far back as Egypt. I mean, some of these clay tablets, they've been preserved. So God commands the prophet to do several dramatic acts of judgment which depict the coming fall of Jerusalem. And this is the beginning of it. It seems these dramatic acts were probably performed in front of his house in public view. It doesn't tell us the details, but it gets the implication because other passages are talking about the elders come to his house to see what he's doing. So by implication, he seems to be doing these events outside of his home every day, every day, and every day. Ezekiel's object lesson employed a soft tile to create a miniature city layout of Jerusalem, like he's going to lay out a drawing of Jerusalem on the clay tablet. It seems to be the picture with the walls, and then siege objects, he'll talk about as we go on in the text, he'll place these objects of siege, that'd be the Babylonians sieging the city, that will go around it. And it all, again, is pointing to this. See, the siege went from 588 to 586, so understand, when Jerusalem was sieged, it wasn't like a one-year event, it was a couple-year event. And so they really were getting desperate, as you can imagine. If you're not able to bring food and water and any kind of help, and you can't leave, come or go, you can see how desperate that's going to be. So he's given this action to communicate how bad it's going to be. So this is one of those clays, and you can see they kind of drew, you can't see the detail from distance, but you see those little lines like the wall of Jerusalem and where the temple would be, and they would draw it out. And that's the idea of what he must have done. And then the people go in and say, well, that looks sort of like Jerusalem. Oh. And so now they're learning, okay, Jerusalem. And what's he doing? What's all this around it? So you can understand that people are going to be asking questions. So the clay tablet in that day meant a brick. They would use the term. Their bricks were not the same size as our bricks, more miniature and square and all that. They would actually call it a brick. This was their writing material. Many of these have been found. They're about 14 inches by 12 inches, roughly, size-wise. So a little bit bigger than a piece of paper, but obviously heavier and thicker. But it would be, because they had clay, and they would use that as a clay, and then, like I said, they can carve in it and then kind of bake it in the sun, and next thing you know, it becomes permanent in there. So the clay tablet was sun-baked, larger than modern bricks. It was probably white clay, and many of us probably seen red clay and different color clay. A lot of it was white clay in that area. This was likely baked clay with an outline of the city scratched into it. Again, you see the idea of the walls, and you can't see it clearly, but they probably understood what the outline of the city of Jerusalem looked like, especially if they were from Jerusalem taken captive. This is one of the actual ones there on the right there. The Lord instructed Ezekiel to construct a model of Jerusalem under siege. That's what he's trying to do. He's dramatizing, here's the city, and he's going to ask him to put the siege objects around it, to surround it, the exact thing that's going to happen to Jerusalem. It's not clear whether the whole model fit on the brick or whether the brick itself just simply represented the city. We don't know. We think that he drew on it, the outline of it, and when you saw that brick, you say, well, okay, that represents Jerusalem. And then as we go on, he's going to tell them to put these objects around the city. So the outline of Jerusalem would have been distinctive and easily recognizable by the people, right? And he may even have labeled the brick as Jerusalem. He wrote the word Jerusalem on there. We don't know exactly, but the point is that brick represents the city. And I think they understood that as time went on. Verse 2, lay siege against it, build a siege wall against it, and heap up a mound against it, set camps against it. You see the word against a little bit there. Set camps against it and place battering rams against it all around. So this is a battle. This is against Jerusalem. This is what God is saying about Jerusalem. I am against you, O Jerusalem. Not a good thing to hear from God, but that's the idea of what's going on there. So Ezekiel built a model of the siege of Jerusalem, which was that brick, right? With enemy siege works, and I'm going to show you a lot of different images, an earth ramp, camps of soldiers, battering rams, much like the boys, we had the army men. Right? I love those army men as a kid, by the way. I had some good battles. But like that idea is what they were doing. He had the little city, and he had the little army men, and then all that is the picture, but the idea was to show this is what's really going to happen in Jerusalem. As much as you don't want to see this, you're going to see it anyway. See, they're not in Jerusalem, but they're going to see it before it happens in Jerusalem and while it's happening in Jerusalem, while they're in captivity. Pretty amazing. So the siege wall that he's describing there was a series of siege towers that were built to put the archers, right, the invaders, on the same level as their ramparts so they can easily shoot arrows into the city. So the idea is they built these, this shows a lot more detail of it, but get the idea is they built up something that's high enough that get them where they're not having to shoot up way up and let it fall randomly into the city where they thought they could actually hit, you know, people, especially those who were guarding the wall. So anyway, they would build these ramparts that would be high so they could come against the city. Now, they were a distance away from the city, but they're good. That's not the only thing they're going to be building, a whole lot. So the picture here is these are somewhat temporary, but you see it's all around the city. The idea is that the middle there is the city. That's Jerusalem. This is obviously a very small scale compared to the whole city. But you get the idea, it looks like a wall all the way around. That wasn't as heavy duty of a wall as the city itself. It's there as a temporary structure. They would use wood, they would use trees, and whatever was around the area. But the whole idea was to make sure nobody can come in and nobody can leave. Just imagine what that does to that city. That puts it in a very, very bad place. It's going to be a very difficult thing. So we call it a siege wall. The idea wasn't always as elaborate, but it looks like a really heavy-duty wall. But all it needed to be was to make sure it stopped people from coming and going, and that's what they did. And again, that didn't happen overnight. That took a while for them to build and build and build, and they connected the dots, so they made the whole wall. So they had to be very, that they being Babylon, would have to be very... had a vested interest in wanting to do this. They must have thought that they needed to take them out. Now we know ultimately it's the Lord using the Babylonians to do this, but the Babylonians had to have some vested interest into wanting to destroy them. They must have thought they're a problem, we need to get rid of them. And so they would stay there for a long time till the task was done. Again, this was an earthen ramp where the ramming instruments, and we'll talk about that in a moment, could be brought against the wall. So right now, I'm just talking about the fact they built a city wall that stopped things from coming and going. But then they get a little bit more aggressive and get closer to the city. So the purpose of the siege was to starve out the enemies and to wear them down by halting their flow of food, right? Supplies, weapons, can't get any more. Whatever you got in the city is all you got. All you got to eat and all that goes with it, and drink if there's any liquid. Because Jerusalem was a well-fortified city, it would take them quite a long time to actually capture it. I get months, but actually many months. It's more than a year, so about a couple of years to actually take it overall. There's a commitment to this. When you say, I'm going to siege a city, you know you're going to be there for a while. This is not, you're going to be in there a few months and you're going to be done. This is at least a year or 2 year process, and it's very, very difficult. Ezekiel was also to build a ramp up to the brick city, so they're going to build a ramp, and I'll show you that in a moment. The ramp provided relatively smooth incline, which with these siege towers and the battering rams, and I have images of that, they could be pushed into the wall. So they got the wall all the way around, and then they start getting where this building up to trying to make it easy for them to get up to the top of the walls. So obviously the point was to eventually they'll be able to breach and get into the city itself without having to break everything down. You got to understand that the toughest part of any city is the foundation. Typically the foundation is going to be the monster, heavy, thick stones, and they're not going to be able to break that. So they got to get up higher, because typically up higher, what do you have? Smaller stones that are easier to break into and compromise. So that height matters when it comes to overtaking the city. So the ramp allowed the attackers to get above the bedrock and the large foundation stones of the city, so the smaller, more vulnerable upper stones could be reached by the battering rams. And again, I'll show you some of those. Should to prevent reinforcements and supplies from coming in and to keep the survivors from getting away, an attacker and army would set up camps all around the besieged city, which I referred to earlier. Just want to make sure you get the idea. Is they're stuck. There's no coming, there's no going, you got whatever's in the city, and they're slowly going to be moving in closer and closer to the city. Pretty scary view. So sometimes they would do things like they'd get a lot of wood, cut a bunch of trees, and they would build them up, and there's a slight incline, and have this big wall that they would use to protect themselves. The guys in the front are in pretty bad shape. The guys that go in first are usually the ones that die. But the whole point is, eventually they get to the point where they get a ramp where they can actually get soldiers inside the city. Scary scenario. Scary as it is, just having them all around you. Even more scary when they're there to kill you and come into the city. So that would be when he mentioned the siege mound. They're building it up. Sometimes it could be just a lot of dirt, and they're slowly throwing more and more dirt, and they're staying protected behind this little wall, this temporary wall, or shield, if you want to call it that, while they keep throwing more dirt or more tree trunks and all that stuff on it, just to try to raise it up. Scary, scary view when you're in the city. And of course, in the meanwhile, they're throwing arrows in that are flaming, and they're trying to catch things on fire and make it difficult. So that some of the different ramming tools, once everything was positioned and the battering rams were brought forward to begin their assault, which is boom, you've seen movies, boom, and it's a big, big boards and big trees and with metal things on the end of it that are just so strong, their assault would be by beating. It's got to be a scary sound if you're in a city, all you're hearing is boom, boom, and you're like, oh my goodness, that's scary, because on the other end of that are the people that want to, once they get in, to kill you. Scary indeed. So these people would be inside. It's kind of a breakaway open. You can see there'd be a lot of people inside, and they're just there, bang, they're swinging on a rope, bang, or a chain, or they're more of a chain or a rope, and they're just, boom, just constantly hitting on the stone, trying to break the wall. Scaring the people to death, as you can imagine. In the meanwhile, they're hoping to crack and break and get into the city itself. These are scary things if they're coming at you, for sure. Verse 3, moreover, take for yourself an iron plate and set it as an iron wall between you and the city. So he's got his block, his brick. It represents the city, and he's going to have this plate that's going to separate him from the city itself. Set your face against it. Again, the word against keeps being used because that's what God's doing. I'm against you, O Israel, in this point. Set your face against it, and it shall be besieged, the city itself, and you shall lay siege against it. This will be a sign to the house of Israel. This whole imagery is to scare them, to get their attention, to get them to repent and to turn back to the Lord. These guys already, I mentioned this last week, they're already kept captives. They should be very motivated to get back in the relationship with the Lord more than anybody, because they're in a bad condition. But anyway, Ezekiel was to place an iron plate between himself and his model of the city and lay siege on Jerusalem. Again, now he's going to be putting objects around the city. With this iron thing, he doesn't say what to do with the iron thing. It doesn't actually, other than between you and the siege city. And there's an image for that in a moment. This was to be a sign to the people of Israel of what God was doing in the real Jerusalem, or will be doing. He'll tell them to start doing this before it happens, and then when it begins to happen, and he ends about the time it really happens in Jerusalem, the real siege. So the meaning of the iron plate or pan is also debatable. It just mentions it. He doesn't give any particulars about it, but I think there's some insights that might help. Though it appears to have been a common cooking griddle, a metal pan that they might have used for cooking on, well, that's what you're going to use as a divider between you and the city that's being sieged. Doesn't give a lot of detail about it other than just do it. So a little bit of image of it would be, there's the idea of the city, the brick. They made that actually look more like a brick. And all these siege objects around it, the sticks or whatever. But the point is, that's like the wall. Nobody can come in, nobody can go out. And he's going to lay down on the side. He'll get into the details of that a little bit more. But then he has this iron plate. Just hold it between you and the city. And they're going to look at it and go, well, what does all that mean? I kind of get it. Especially if he scribbled the outline of the city of Jerusalem on the brick, they probably go, oh, I recognize that. And then they tell everybody, and everybody knows, well, he's got this block, and he's got the Jerusalem drawn out, and he's got all these little pegs all around, and as they're trying to tell their people, the elders that come to the home, he mentioned them several times, they're going to come to the home, watch it, and he's not going to say anything. He's just going to have this image, and this is, they're going to look at this and have to go back and tell the people what we saw was, and they try to describe it. So there's the iron plate, just a simple a plate of some sort that might have been used for cooking. Some see this to have signified the Babylonian army that made escape from the city impossible, trying to describe why he's using this metal plate. Is it the army itself? Could be, but I think it's going to be a little bit bigger than that. Some say to see the iron plate as a sin barrier between the Jews and God, between Israel and God, and that's probably more likely to picture. See, he is the one that is, Ezekiel's doing the dramatization. He's the one doing it, and his picture is he's representing God, and there's this wall, this iron plate between him and the siege, and they're going to cry out to him, and it's not getting to God. It's hitting the metal plate is the idea, and their prayers are not being heard is the picture. They're beyond that point, this is going to happen at this point. So this seems to be part of the picture. Their relationship to the Lord is the point of this whole siege, right? Evidently, Ezekiel built this model scene without speaking to his audience. There's nothing there for him to say or explain what it was, what he was doing. He didn't explain anything. He just did it outside of his house. And again, we got the other places that where it talked about the elders came to him to see what he was doing. Why did they know to go there? God told them to go there. I don't know. Somehow they knew to go to him. He's being called as a prophet. He's not saying a lot, but he's doing some weird things, right? And so we're trying to see what God is saying to us. So in context, it seems to relate to God setting his face against his own people, not hearing their cries for help. What Ezekiel 3 talks about, I'm not going to hear their cries, right? I mean, individuals are one thing, and when it comes to salvation, it's a different thing. They can believe in him. But as a nation, they're in trouble. As a nation, they're going to go through a very difficult judgment. As the siege progressed, Jerusalem will cry out for deliverance, but God will not answer her prayers. And he mentioned that. Even Jeremiah talked about that. I will not hear their prayers, because he knows they're beyond that certain point that God said. They're beyond the point of return. I'm not going to even hear their prayers. So the purpose of God in this prophetic act was hardly limited to letting Ezekiel and his countrymen in on the future. It's not just, oh, we just want to let you see what's going to happen. Oh, no, it's a lot more. It's intended to change their heart. It's intended to change their way of looking and their relationship with the Lord. More important was their need to see that God was not about to let the sins of the city he had chosen go unpunished. So he's not going to let them go unpunished. They're going to be judged. They always thought they were so favored that no matter what, nothing could happen. And we certainly know nothing's going to happen to the temple, right? Well, gee, you're wrong. They're very wrong when they were thinking that. Verse 4, lie also on your left side and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it. So the idea is where he's going to lie on his left side, lay down. And the iniquity is right there, that tension point on the ground. It's like he's burying the sin of Israel. And God says, according to the number of the days that you lie on it, you shall bear their iniquity. He's going to give you the number of days that he's going to lie on it. And he's saying that represents God's view of their sin. And he's going to divide up Judah and Israel in this case. As we go on, we'll see that. So God commands the prophet to lie on his left side to bear it, to carry the sin of Israel. The point is, he's not staying there for 390 days total. He's not like, okay, I can't get up. I got to go to the bathroom. I got to get food. I don't know that weird stuff. He did it for a while because at the same time, he's going to tell him to do some other acts that are about cooking that he's going to be doing during the same time. So the 390 days he'll mention in a moment here is he'll be doing that for that longer period of time, 390 days on his one side, and they're just going to look at him. Why is he staying on his? He's always on his one side. Eventually, he'll go over to the other side. But all those days represented something that they need to learn from it. Ezekiel's actions do not cause God to spare Jerusalem, but to judge it. I mean, he's using it as a way of dramatizing God's judgment. Ezekiel's acts show the extent or the longevity of the people's rebellion, and there's more for one than the other three, 90 for one for Israel, 40 for Judah, and as he's going to divide it out later. So there's a lot of commands here that God gives to him, not to speak at this point, but commands. He says, if one, get a brick, set it before you, inscribe or outline Jerusalem on it appears, or the word Jerusalem, so they understood what it was. No more than that. That's the most communication he does, right? Build a siege wall with ramps around the brick, so you get an idea of encamping it like a siege. Place battering rams there up against the wall to make it more scary. So maybe while he was there, he was rolling up sand up against the brick, you know, like they would be doing, is to get it higher and higher. And maybe he has some kind of instrument he would use that looked like a battering ram. And to be, oh, you know, the idea is to be very scary. Every day he would do the same thing. He'd bring up more sand. He'd smooth it out probably every day. And he would just pile up the sand up against the brick, give you the view of what's going to happen to the city. So he says, get an iron plate. Kind of, it seems to be as a divider between the people in the city and God. They can't get to God, and there's a wall here, there's a barrier there. Lie on your side. Then later on, you get to, he's going to tell them to take food items. He's going to take some food items. He'll talk about that. And we get to chapter 5, is where he's again going to talk about his hair is going to be cut off, and he's going to divide it up and put it in different places. This is all building a scene, very, very significant scene. Verse 5, for I have laid on you the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days, so you shall bear the iniquity of the house of Israel for 390 days. Now Judah, Israel, Judah's going to come up in a moment for the 40 days. But the point is, of course, when you think about Israel, when they were taken out, which was before this time, you know, they were scattered around the world, and technically they're still scattered around the world. Only God knows who they are, who are of the 12 tribes, or the 10 tribes that especially got scattered. So anyway, let's go on. Each day symbolized the year. That's it seems to be what he's saying there. It's going to represents the number of days or years. Then Ezekiel was to recline in public on his left side for 390 days, I'm just summarizing it. This was to represent the number of years that Israel would have to bear the punishment for her sins. Well, obviously more than 390 years, because again, they're still scattered abroad. They're still scattered even today. So when it comes, one thing that's very clear is, myself always want to know what everything, there's a number, I want to know what that number means. One thing about it, God doesn't tell us what the number means. He gives us a 390 for Israel, he's going to give us 40 days for Judah, and we go, I don't know what that means. We just don't know. No commentator has a clear, obvious answer as to what that represents. God does. He had a reason for it, the 390 and the 40, and to him it means something, but the whole point of it is to get their attention, right? Here, when he says the house of Israel means the northern 10 tribes, because he's referring specifically, the 390 is referring specifically to the 10 tribes, which are already in judgment. That was back in 722 BC when the Assyrians came in. They're already scattered abroad, right? So what we're referring to in Ezekiel's time would be only the Jews down in Judah to the south. So Ezekiel is told to lie on his side to show the sin of both Israel, and then he'll get the verse next verse, he'll talk about the same thing for Judah. 390 and then 40, right? Verse 6, and when you have completed them, lie again on your right side. He was just 390 on his left side. Now he's going to be 40 days on his right side. Then you shall bear the iniquity of the house of Judah, right? So he divided, distinguished between Israel and Judah for 40 days. I have laid on you a day for each year. So that's where we understand a day represents a year. Now, people do really bizarre things with day and years when it comes to prophecy, and some of that is just absurd. But anyway, people, it meant something for God, specifically as it relates to Israel, right? So, lying on his side, likely facing north. Some say that when he was lying on his left side for 390 days, he might have looked to the north, and then when he's lying on his right side, he might have been looking in the direction of the south. That's reading into the text, but the idea is the distinguishing between Israel and Judah is what he was doing, right? applying it to Israel, facing south would be pointing to Judah, like they were divided to northern tribes and the southern tribes. So he looked one, then he looked the other. Again, he's not in Jerusalem. He's actually in Babylon doing this representation. It's not necessary to assume that Ezekiel was on his side this whole time. Again, he wasn't laying there for 390 days and he never got up. That's not what happened. But he did this dramatization every single day. Every day they would come to see it, and they saw the same thing, and eventually they would go, well, this is getting kind of old and kind of boring, but is it? But they had to be realizing, but this is what's really going to be, and that as time went on, especially the first year, it wasn't happening in Jerusalem, but then it started to happen, and they probably got word that, oh, Babylon is now sieging Jerusalem. Oh, this is what Ezekiel's been doing. You can see they're beginning to go, wait a minute, this is really happening. But we've been told this at least a year in advance before it started to happen. Now that he's dramatizing it and they're hearing that it's actually happening, it's probably not boring anymore. They're like, oh, this is real. This is a real big thing. So he was also doubtless upright part of the day, meaning he wasn't laying on the side all day long as he needed to prepare food. There's a couple of verses from there. He'll talk about the preparing of food. That would be the kind of way you would have to prepare your food if you're in Jerusalem in the middle of that siege. He'll get into that in a moment. Judah was also guilty, but the 40 cannot represent less guilt. Now, just because it's less days doesn't mean they're less guilty, but there's a lot to go with. They're all guilty. That's why the judge, I mean, again, Israel's already been taken out of the scene. They've been scattered abroad. So not like they're less guilty. Jerusalem and the Judahites are, it's because of them that this judgment is happening. It's already happened to the north. Now, don't think that just because, well, 40 days, they weren't so bad. Though they were just as bad. It just didn't happen over as long a period of time as it did with Israel. So after the 390 days had expired, he was to lie on his right side for an additional 40 days. Again, all this is dramatized. This was to represent the number of additional years the southern kingdom of Judah would have to suffer punishment for his sins. It seems that one seems to have more of a tie to how long they're going to be in this period of captivity in Jerusalem, in Babylon, right? As they were taken, it seems to represent, because it seems to tie to when the captivity, 70-year captivity, finally ends. But the 390 for Israel, there's no clear reference as to what that represents. All we know is it relates to the 10 northern tribes, which have already been scattered abroad. Okay, that these days represent years of divine punishment seems clear, but what those years are is not clear. He doesn't say exactly why. Like in Jeremiah, when he talks about the 70 years that they're going to endure, he actually talks about the details, because they did not keep my Sabbaths, right? Every 7 year, they're supposed to keep a Sabbath. But he didn't for 490 years. And so 490 years, and they take one each year. So, you put that divided out, it comes out to 70 years. That's why there's 70 years of captivity. So those are clearly told us what those numbers represent. But here, the 390, again, he doesn't actually give us a good answer. It gets, and even today, you would think we'd have figured it out. But this is a God thing. Why God divided these years into two such unusual segments remains a mystery. I'll just leave it at that, because we just don't know. Nobody knows for sure. In some way, the length of the siege corresponds to the past years of Israel and Judah's sin. That's the most that we do know. It has to do with their sin. And God's got some kind of way of calculating and looking at it and determining what is right and what kind of judgment is right for them and all that goes with it, though we just don't fully get it. Verse 7, therefore you shall set your face towards the siege of Jerusalem, your arm shall be uncovered, and you shall prophesy against it. The prophesying isn't words. It, you know, when you get ready to go to battle, you all seen it. Two guys getting ready to go at the battle with each other. What do they do? They take their coat off, right? And they bare their arms. And now you can see they're getting ready to do battle. That's kind of the picture here. When he talks about bearing his arm, it's the idea, I'm getting ready to do something dramatic. I'm getting ready to do something big. we see that, like I mentioned, the idea in the context of a fight. Well, that's kind of like a fight. He's going to be showing. He's not going to be fighting the people, but he's going to be showing the idea of being prepared to do something dramatic, and that's what he's doing. So to have the arm uncovered is a symbol for being ready for action, as a soldier would do so. You know, some encumbrance, you got to get it out of your way. And so you would bare your arm, make it free so you can move around free. Isaiah 52 is a good example, verse 10. The Lord has made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations. See, it's like the Lord getting ready to do something. He doesn't have an arm, doesn't have sleeves. But the picture is he's anthropomorphizing himself, making himself look like a human, acting like a human. As you get ready to bear an action, you take off the long sleeve and get ready for this action. He says, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God. He's getting ready to do something. He bears his arm to do something. In that context, it's a good thing. In most contexts, it's about to do something dramatic and evil or bad. He was to face Jerusalem with his arm bared, signifying God, Yahweh's hostility towards his people, right? And that's the picture that it represents there. The prophesying that he was to do against Jerusalem was by means of this skit. This is the prophesying. He's prophesying without words, but by dramatizing. I think that's pretty significant. Verse 8, and surely I will restrain you. This is God speaking to Ezekiel. I will restrain you so that you cannot turn from one side to the other till you have ended the days of your siege. Now, again, that doesn't mean that he's sitting there stuck there for 390 days or 40 days at a time. There are other things he's going to tell him to do during this time. But when he's doing it, it's always going to be the same way for those 390 and 40 days. It's always going to do it every single day, same way. But this was to symbolize the impossibility. This is now getting an understanding while he's restrained. Is to symbolize the impossibility of the Jews being able to shake off their punishment. When they're in the city, there's nothing they can do to stop it. They're being sieged. They're stuck. They can't shake it off. They can't move. It appears that the prophet acted out his drama for only a few hours each day. And it was during this time that God enabled him to lie there quietly. And again, he spoke nothing. So every day they would see the same thing. Ezekiel was not allowed to move, symbolizing the fact that the people of Jerusalem in the siege, right, would be imprisoned within the walls of the city. I mean, during their own city, yay, we're in our own city, but we're prisoners in our own city, right? And that is the picture. You can't move. They're stuck there. And that's kind of the picture of what's going on, I think, with Ezekiel. God's judgment of sin is inevitable. He is long-suffering and may wait for years, and he obviously did, but ultimately he will dispense judgment, right? They kept rejecting him. We go back and look at all the prophets that came beforehand about this sin and their sin, and they were given lots of warning, and they didn't seem to heed it. Faithfulness involves sticking to task where the reward cannot necessarily be experienced right away. And I think it's interesting. He's doing this act, and he's being faithful to the Lord, but it's going to be a tough thing that he's doing. I mean, he has to see it himself. And the idea is sometimes the Lord puts us through some difficult things, and we can't, and we may not necessarily see the reward in this life. Let me just say it that way. So loyal Christian servants may not see in this life the rewards of their steady labors, right? You steadily, consistently do things in the name of Jesus, and you do it to honor him and all that. And maybe nobody even knows it, and you're doing it, what's a great thing, but God does. And you may not be rewarded in this life, and that's okay, because you know ultimately you'll be with the Lord, and he'll take a good reckoning of what you're doing. But we carry on because God's work is never done in vain, no matter how hard it may be. And that should be an encouragement there. And everything we do, 1 Corinthians 15, is unto the Lord, right? Everything we do is to honor him. So literal or literary, and sometimes you have to ask yourself some questions as you read the text. What's going on in the text? Is it some kind of literary? Some people want to make it literary, and I want to take it as more literal. I'll show you what I mean. So Ezekiel 4:8, we just read, and surely I will restrain you so that you cannot turn from one side to another till you have ended the days of your siege, you know, the 390 days, and then the other side, on the right side, the 40 days. So God will restrain you. Ezekiel 3:25, and he mentioned this one time, and you, O son of man, surely they will put ropes on you and bind you with them. So it's like they're going to tie ropes on you. Is it like the elders coming doing that? So that you cannot go out from among them. The idea, so who's binding them? Is God doing this or the elders doing it? It doesn't, it's only mentioned the one time in Ezekiel 3:25 where they're going to bind him. They're going to seemingly tie his hands together. Maybe they do that one time. I don't know. But in the end, God's saying he's the one who's doing it. So it seems that the prophet was limited to his home, and that every time we see him, he seems to be outside of his home. That's where the elders come to. And then the elders had to go there to see him in chapter 8. He'll talk about that. Chapter 14, chapter 20. So you have all those different chapters where they come to his home. So that obviously is where the scene is taking place. So I say literary or literal. Did they actually tie his hands, or literary? Some people take it to mean it's symbolic, that because God's really the one making him stay on this one side for that period of time, or is it that they did it themselves? It doesn't say that they did it, other than the implication is they're doing it. And I think the idea is the people who are watching are just like the people in Jerusalem. They're rejecting God. And they're going to do anything they can to restrain and hold back listening to the prophet. There's a lot of implication inside there. So that was the first beginning of the dramatization. There's another one. He's going to go on. The second one is concerning food. Now, verses 9 through 17, which ends the chapter, actually. But this one is the one they want to go, this is kind of gross, but let's read what it says. Verse 9. Also, take for yourself wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, and splint. Put them into a vessel. And notice there's a variety. It's not like one. Usually when you make bread, you just make it out of one or another. Or, usually it's just one. But there's so little available that they're having to throw scraps together of all kinds of things. Because the idea is what's happening in Jerusalem is they're running out of food. And they're making any bread out of whatever they can. I got a little bit of this left. I got a little bit of that. They're doing whatever they can to try to make it, right? And he says, and to make bread for them, for yourself, during the number of days that you lie on your side, 390 days, you shall eat it. All right, so he's going to get into the details of it. So he's using all this variety for a purpose. It's the picture that they don't have a lot to work with. So they're using everything they can to throw in there to try to make it look like a real meal. The second dramatization took place while Ezekiel was acting out that 390. So he got the ramparts and the building the sand up to the walls of the city and all that picture. What's going on in the city is them trying to eat, right? That's what's going on inside the city. The main drama pictured a siege as a judgment from God. This aspect of it stressed the severe conditions that would exist in the city while they're being sieged. So he's talking about what the siege itself and the ramparts and all the battle that they're bringing in and getting closer and closer to the city. In the meanwhile, those in the city are running out of food and they're making bread out of anything and everything, right? Whatever they can. What he ate and drank and how much he ate and drank was significant. We'll get to that in a little bit here. The siege, the first drama, would cause famine, which causes a second drama. So there's a logical progression there, right? So they got the siege, they're running out of food. So what's going to happen next is famine, right? Because there's no food coming in and out of the city. Verse 10. And your food, which you shall eat, shall be by weight. I mean, you're portioning it out. You're trying to make it last. 20 shekels a day. From time to time, you shall eat at a certain time, always at a certain time, and only so much and no more. You're trying to ration out the food. That's what will be going on inside the city. Ezekiel may have eaten at other times of the day when he was not acting out his drama, but during his dramatic presentation, each day, he only ate and drank as people under siege in Jerusalem would at a certain time, certain amount, and no more. They're seeing that. The people are going, well, he's only eating. Why is he eating just so little? Well, that's what's going on in the city. In reality, the 20 shekels, as it described it, would be about 8 ounces, which isn't a lot. You make foods and you make cakes and you make it into 8 ounces. Isn't a whole lot, is it? And then he says 8 ounces. Well, 1/6 of a hin, he'll describe that, it would be less than a quart, would be the famine rations. From time to time, when he says from time to time, it is a Hebrew idiom. It just means at a certain time, every day, consistently, at a certain time, like a clockwork, if you will. Verse 11, you shall also drink water by measure, 1/6 of a hin. From time to time you shall drink it. And so you get the certain amount for the whole day, and that's all you get. There's no more. You can't have any more. At least on the dramatization that people see, it's limited as to how much he takes. With this small amount, Ezekiel would lose weight, probably himself, unless he was eating more outside the dramatization, and strengthen, and his strength would mimic the siege condition. As he's seemingly getting weaker and looking a little more pale himself, that's exactly what's happening in Jerusalem. So I said, this is a hard thing. It might be easier to just go, thus saith the Lord, and go out there and have a good meal and tell everybody in words. But no, he's actually enacting this out, and it may very well have an effect on his actual health himself. So now, this is what gets interesting. Food baked from human excrement. This is what God says to do. This is the condition that's going to be in the city of Jerusalem. You shall eat it as barley cakes and bake it using fuel of human waste in their sight. So, I mean, it doesn't sound very fun. The food isn't the human waste, but what they're using as fuel to cook it would be human waste. I want to understand what part of it he's referring to. So bread was baked on hot stones, heated by human waste, because no other fuel was available. Eventually they run out of fuel. How are we going to cook this? We can't come and go, and our flint's hardly working. We have nothing, no straw to cook or whatever we're going to use. This is what we have left. You get it's pretty desperate. This was repulsive and polluting, according to Deuteronomy. So the Lord calls it defiled bread. He's going to call it defiled. You need to eat this defiled bread. And it was repulsive, you can imagine. It must be noted that the command regarding human waste relates only to the fuel, not the food. They weren't eating human waste. They were cooking this bread in the scarcity of this bread using human waste. Ezekiel was to bake his food over a fire made with human excrement, as the Jews under siege in Jerusalem would have to. Again, they were running out of fuel. What are we going to cook with? That is a desperate, kind of a desperate condition, as you can imagine. That's kind of the point. In parts of the Middle East, even today in India, where they don't have a lot of wood or straw or anything, they actually use animal feces, right, to cook with. They even today, there are places that still do that. So there would be no wood or oil to cook with, so animal dung would be the only source. Now, they would have all these things, but when they ran out, you see, this is the point they're getting to, the point of running out of materials. So they're getting desperate in what's available. If nothing was left in the city that could be burned, it would be impossible to continue to follow God's laws for sacrifice. There's so much going on here. There's so much devastation, so much heartache going on. There's nothing they could do that they thought that they could please God. They're just trying to survive, let alone have any sacrifices, or none of that's going to be available for them. The dried dung burned slowly and probably gave off an unpleasant odor. I guess we get that. We understand how that could be. Ezekiel was to bake his bread in the sight of the people using human excrement for fuel. God's going to change that a little bit, but that's the idea, what God told him to do at this point. Though the law did not specifically prohibit the use of human dung for cooking, its guidelines regarding disposal of human excrement, right, was suggested as improper. The way he says to make sure that it's taken care of and cleaned off and not kept in the camp, there was a means of keeping it out and keeping it separate, suggests that it's not something we should be using normally. But God's saying this is an unusual condition, so you're going to have to use it anyway. Then the Lord says, so shall the children of Israel eat their defiled bread, as he's calling it, among the Gentiles where I will drive them. So this is what they're already in. They're in Babylon. He's going to have to do this, again, dramatizing what's going on in Jerusalem. So the uncleanness of their food did not represent the type of food that they would eat, but the fact that they would have to eat their food among defiled people is also the picture. So everything's defiled. The food is defiled, it is using defiled fuel, and they'll be eating it among Gentiles. So this became more personal for those guys in Babylon, right? Because they're already there, eating among the Gentiles, eating among the Babylonians. But for those in Jerusalem, it meant that's where they're headed. They're headed in the same place, either death, many of them will die, or if they do survive, they will end up in Babylon also, and they will be eating among the Gentiles. So that's the picture. God will drive the people out of the promised land, and I have a bunch of verses in Jeremiah to talk about that, saying he's going to take them out of the land. But Jeremiah is the one that tells them that how long it's going to last, for 70 years. Ezekiel represents Yahweh's message, or God's message, of the destruction of exile of Jerusalem until it happens, and the message changes. Eventually the message will change, but not till we get to chapter 33, which is the message of hope. But between now and up to chapter 33, it's not a lot of hope there at all. It's all about judgment. A couple more verses. So I said, "Ah, Lord God, indeed I have never defiled myself from my youth till now." He's a priestly tribe. And so as a priest, there was a lot more regulation and a lot more conditions that they would separate themselves than even a normal person would. "I have never eaten what died of itself or was torn by beasts," the old regulation from the law, "nor has or eaten any abominable flesh ever come into my mouth." Nothing is this, you know, an abominable thing by your standard have I ever eaten. So he's like, I can't imagine your God, you're telling me to do this, right? So Ezekiel, like Daniel, had convictions to be undefiled even in his food. They had conditions they did not want to do, and there's a little difference there. Is Daniel was proving himself. God was going to make them stay healthy. Even when they didn't have protein, they didn't have all the good food, God kept them healthy, but that was special. This is obviously about a judgment. God permitted fuel of dried cow chips, I guess we'll call it, for cooking his food in a gracious indifference. He'll talk about that. He'll give them, okay, if you don't want to use you, they're going to end up doing a real human instrument in Jerusalem, but I'll allow for you because it's really, you're squeamish about it, really bad, and so I'll allow it to be instrument from, you know, an animal. God accepted or acceded to Ezekiel's request to substitute animal dung for human feces because the prophet wished to preserve his own purity and because the use of human waste, right, is pretty repulsive. The more realistic it would have been, the human waste would be more realistic, was essentially the lesson for Ezekiel was for the people. It wasn't as much for him to learn it, he's getting it, but it was really for the other people to see. So anyway, there's a lot of passages we can look at. Acts chapter 10, Peter says this. Remember this in Jerusalem council here. But Peter said, "Not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean." And then a voice spoke to him again, "What God has called clean, don't you call unclean." Now, it's a different context, but you get the idea. They're still very sensitive about what they eat and based on the law. And so the law told them what they can and cannot eat. Ezekiel had always kept God's dietary laws, as Deuteronomy 14 talks about. As a priest, he was careful to keep himself undefiled, and there's more details as a priest than even a regular person. And God was asking him to do the extreme, right, in this context. So God responds to the prophet's squeamishness, right, and allows cow dung to be substituted for the fuel so he doesn't have to use real human dung. Pretty gross, but there we are. But if you get the picture, this is bad conditions in Jerusalem. Then he said to me, "See, I am giving you cow dung instead of human waste, and you shall prepare your bread over it." And so he gives them an exception to the rule. It's for their sake and not for your sake, so I'll allow this. The prophet complained that he had never eaten the unclean food, so God gave this. So less of a stigma was associated with eating cow dung than eating human. So God let Ezekiel, I just want to make that point. He makes it clear that he's given this exception. Two verses. "Moreover, he said to me, Son of man, surely I will cut off the supply of bread in Jerusalem," right? That would be because of the siege, right? "They shall eat bread by weight and with anxiety," as you can imagine. Oh no, this is all we got. once I eat this, it's all gone, you know. And shall drink water by measure and with dread, because we're about to run out of that too. That's pretty significant. All these conditions were to symbolize how people back in Jerusalem were going to have to eat and live during that time. Very, very difficult. They would have to eat sparingly because the famine caused the siege to be very severe. The siege means no food in and out. The purpose of his eating and drinking this meager rations was to show the scarcity of the food in Jerusalem during the siege. So he's kind of enduring it to some degree himself, but the real event is what's going on back in Jerusalem. Last verse. They continues the thought that they may lack bread and water, which is what was going on in the city, and be dismayed with one another and waste away because of their iniquity. That's not the way you want to lose weight, right? I mean, you know, they're losing weight and they're wasting away, but because they're dying is really what's going on. So they were soon to have neither bread nor water in any amount, and they would grieve over the famine and their iniquity. I mean, it's going to be very hard. When he says to waste away in their iniquity was the idea of, you know, to fester, you have a sore, it festers and it pusses, and they're festering, they're dying, is the picture there. So Ezekiel, as a trained priest, drew much of his vocabulary from Leviticus. He used a lot of terms that were things that were used in Leviticus. And so that's chapter 4. Let me go ahead and close. Father, thank you so much for your word. Sometimes you make things so dramatic and so real, and maybe even a little bit disgusting sounding, but that you're making a point. You're trying to get their attention. And we pray that we don't become so hard-headed like they were, and so stiff-necked, and always thinking selfishly. Humble our hearts, Father, to serve you. And we pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.